Welcome once again to our financial class. Again, this is your host, Kevin Jones, and I am pleased to be with you. For starters, let's say again, just for those of you, this may be your first class. We want to make it extremely clear. This is not for advice purposes. It's for educational purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for anything pertaining to investments that you make, anything that you do for retirement, savings, spending. We're only providing this class for educational purposes only. Having said this, let's go into our lesson. All right, this is the first lesson. This is the first lesson today for our series. This is the first lesson, and I'm glad that you're here. And so those of you who listened to the introductory course, you had an assignment that was given to you, and I trust that you have been diligent about completing your assignment. It is very important that when assignments are given, that you make sure that you're completing those assignments, okay? Very, very important. So, now, as with any class, before we get into the meat and potatoes of any class, we first have to go into the basics. We have to lay a foundation. So I'm going to be giving you some material. I trust that you do have your notebook, your financial notebook that you're going to be keeping notes on. And in this session, in this session, we're going to cover, we're going to try to get through understanding the specifics of registering securities, recognizing security underwriters, knowing the type of offerings, spotting exempt securities, reviewing additional topics related to this subject. So the reason that we are starting here is I want to give you a basic understanding so that you understand when you start deciding to make your trades or do your investments, whether you're going to go into the stock market or whether you're going to purchase mutual funds, ETFs, REITs, and some of these words you won't understand right now because unless you have a financial background, but as we go on, you may want to buy treasury notes, you may want to buy debt securities. There's all types of things. You may want to get into the commodities market. You may want to get into option trading. So we're going to talk about this. And so to understand it, when we get to the meat of this, I'm going to give you the very foundation. Now, let me go ahead and give you your assignment for today that you need to do before you listen to the next session. Your assignment today is to pick a brokerage firm and open up a brokerage account. Pick a brokerage firm and open up a brokerage account. You can choose a company like Charles Schwab, any type of brokerage firm. I want you to do that. You could use Fidelity. You could use any brokerage home, okay? When you open up your brokerage account, you want to open up a brokerage account, and you also want to open up a banking account. You're going to accept the debit card because you need a way to transfer money into your brokerage account. You also need to have access to your money. Now, the brokerage account, typically with most brokerage houses, there's no amount that you have to deposit to open up the brokerage account. Now, the brokerage account is the account that when you start making your trades, you'll use your brokerage account to make trades. So when you make your trades, you'll fund that through linking your brokerage banking account to that account. Or if you have an outside checking or savings account, even a Cash App, you can link that account where you can fund the brokerage account. Then when you have that money in there, you will be able to make the trades for whatever stocks or whatever you want to purchase, and you'll be able to monitor the growth, okay? And we're going to get into, before you're purchasing stock, and this will be sometime down the road, how to read over information about the stock. And each particular company has a grade. You know, is it A+? Is it a B, C, D, whatever? We'll teach you how to read that information to make a determination, teach you how to find important information about that particular company and the principles within that company so that you can make a valiant decision before you make your purchases, okay? All right, so let me read a statement to you. All issuers of securities need a starting point. Now, when we talk in terms of securities, we're talking about things that you're trading on the stock market, okay? Even those of you who participate in a 401k, these are based off of index stocks or index funds, or it's based off of cap funds, ETFs, mutual funds. So don't think that even if you're in a 401k that you don't have to pay attention to your investment. You need to see if your particular investment, where you're putting your money in, is working for you. It's working for you. You always can adjust it, okay? Typically, in a 401k plan, your company has a company that is administering over it, and they can do it all. Sometimes they have AI intelligence that can kind of you put in information to say when you want to retire, how much you make, how much you want to put in every month. Do you want to increase it as you get an increase, things of that nature. But I always say, even if you're using the AI technology, that you keep an eye on your securities, your investment, to make sure it has the right mix for you. All right. So again, all issuers of securities need a starting point, just as all securities need a birth date. And when we talk about birth date, this is not, you know, a birth date like happy birthday. This is the date of the stock. Okay. So most securities will go through a registration process before the public can buy them. So before a issuer of any type of security can sell it to you, they have to go through a certain registration process, because you must understand the SEC and FINRA and all these regulatory boards that oversee, because there was a time when there was some scrupulous activity going on in the stock market with junk bonds and, you know, all of these pyramid schemes and things of this nature. And of course, there's still individuals that are scrupulous. So this is why you have to be the overseer of your own finances. My heart broke for all those people who lost money during the housing bubble crisis, and even during the tech crises, all those people who lost money. And they all have one thing in common, as I always say to everyone, is that they handed their finances over to a trusted friend or colleague or through a recommendation, and they thought that they did not have to preside over their finances. And so when you're not looking over your own finances, you're doing yourself an injustice. All right, so we're going to talk about what does it take to bring a new issue to the market. When we talk about new issue, this is synonymous with you know, a security, a stock, a bond, whatever you want to call it. So we talk about this. We're going to talk about what does it take to bring it to the market. You're going to talk about, we're going to find out about the key players, the type of security offerings, kind of securities that don't need to be registered, and other details about the underwriting process. There is an underwriting process that takes place when you're dealing with securities, okay? So let's go to the first part of this. We're going to talk about beginning new issues or bringing new issues to the market. So how does a company bring a new issue, a new stock, a new bond, a new treasury, whatever, just anything that's related to an investment, okay? So there's a lot of things that need to happen before securities hit the market, okay? So I want you to imagine what a company has to go through nowadays to bring their security to the market. Not only does it have to be registered, but the issuer has to find a company or a firm to sell the securities to the public. So let's just say, for clarity, let's say Clapback wants to sell stock in the Clapback Nation. So I would go through the process of, you know, deciding what type of security I'm going to be selling to the public. And we'll get into all the other things pertaining to that, that we have to do all of the registrations, that we have to do all the information. But I then would go out and find a company, a brokerage firm, to go out and sell the securities for me. I am not going to sell the securities myself. I'm going to have someone else, some other firm, organization that is going to be responsible for selling my securities to the public. So me as the issuer, what's the start? What is the starting point? Okay, for an entity to become a corporation, the founders must file documents called corporate charters or corporate charter bylaws in the home state it's going to do business in. Now, here is what's important to know about that. Included in the corporate charter are the names of the founders, the type of business, the place of business, the amount of shares that can be issued, so forth and so on. Now, you may say, why is this important to me? It is very important that you understand the business that you are investing in. Not only understand the business that you're investing in, it is very important that you understand the principles in the business. You wouldn't probably want to invest in a company where the primary principle of the organization is a known shyster or bank robber. Can you imagine Bernie Madoff coming out of prison and trying to sell securities? I don't think many people would trust him after what he did to his own flesh and blood and friends and relatives that were close to him just to fund his lifestyle. So this information is important to know about the individuals and the corporation itself. So if a corporation wants to sell securities to the public, it has to register with the state and the Security Exchange Commission. Okay. So that's the SEC. It has to register it. And there's a long registration process. Not going to get into the weeds. Again, this is just foundation before we get into the real investments. Now, a couple acts that I want you to be familiar with is there are some security acts that you need to kind of remember, but you don't necessarily have to remember them word for word. So registration helps ensure that securities issued to the public adhere to certain regulations. Okay. Now here are a couple acts that I want you to kind of remember. So write it down. The Securities Act of 1933. The Security Act of 1933. This act, also called the Truth in Securities Act, the Paper Act, the Full Disclosure Act, and the New Issues Act, regulate new issues of corporate securities. An issuer of corporate securities must provide a full and fair disclosure about itself and the offerings. Included in this act are rules to prevent fraud and deception. So this is a full disclosure, you know, because, again, there was things happening prior to 1933. So these acts went in place to try to protect the consumer of securities. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Act of 1934, which was established by the SEC, was enacted to protect investors by regulating the over-the-counter OTC market and exchange, such as the New York Stock Exchange. Now, we'll get into what OTC, over-the-counter exchange, means. You don't need to know that right now, but you will understand that in the future. Let's see. So in addition to the Act of 1934 regulations, the extension of credit in margin accounts. We'll talk about what a margin account is. Transaction by insiders, customer accounts, trading activities. So there's different type of accounts. There are things related to insider trading. All of this. Sorry about that. All of this is something that you need to know in general. Okay. Then the last particular one that I want you to be familiar with is the Trust Indenture Act of 1939. This act prohibits bond issuers valued at over $5 million from being offered to investors without an indenture. The trust indenture is a written agreement to protect investors by disclosing the particulars of the issue or the coupon rate, maturity date, and collateral backing the bond, and so on. So when you're issuing a bond, you know, what is standing behind that bond? I mean, is it just air or is it an actual building? As part of the Trust Indenture Act of 1939, all companies must hire a trustee who's responsible for protecting the rights of the bond holder. So this was enacted for issuers or issuances of bonds. Again, you know, what is behind the bond that you're buying? You know, anybody can just, if it wasn't for some of these acts, anyone could just open up shop and say, I'm sell you a bond. And that bond is just worth as much as the paper and the ink that printed it. And that's it. But what's behind the bond? So if you buy a particular bond in XYZ Corporation and they have their building, they have other assets that are backing that bond. So if anything goes wrong, you will be able to mitigate your particular loss. You need to be thinking in terms of mitigation and not only mitigation, you want to think in terms of how you're able to adjust for loss. Okay. And when we think in terms of adjusting for loss, one of the things you can think in terms of in your investment strategy and in your financial strategy overall, whatever you spend, whatever you lose, it must not and cannot impact your overall lifestyle. You should never invest or buy anything that alters your current lifestyle and ability to continue to save. Many people get in trouble because you purchase a big item or something happens where it changes your life. It alters your life because although we all know that we need to save, saving is not a priority for us. Remember in the introductory, we talked about how the average debt of each adult in America on average is around $60,000. It's over $14 trillion of debt in America. And that averages out to as each adult having around $60,000 of debt. There are people who don't even make $60,000. So we know that typically what happens in our lives when tragedy strikes, if we don't have a nest egg saved up for particular emergencies. And let's go ahead and talk about this right now. Let's talk about your emergency fund. I always tell people that when you get paid, the first person that you need to pay is yourself, whether it's 10% of your income, no more than 20%. After you pay yourself, then you pay your you set aside emergency fund money. This is money that's going to go into some type of a saving apparatus, preferably not a savings account, because you're not going to be gaining interest. We'll talk about different ways where you can hide that money, or not hide it. You can place that money in places where it will gain more interest is what I want to say. I was thinking about how I was going to say that. But you want to be able to maximize on it so that when that money is, as long as you're leaving it there, it's growing for you. It's growing for you. So that when you do have a crisis, and you will, you will be able to continue on with your life without altering your life significantly. Okay, so you want to set aside. So you're going to pay yourself first, anywhere from 10 to 20%. Okay, that's your money. You work for it, you pay yourself. Then you decide, you set aside an amount every pay period. Whenever you get paid, if you get paid every week or if you get paid every 2 weeks, if you get paid once a month, if you get paid twice a month, then you're going to set aside a certain amount for emergency fund and you're not going to touch that money. An emergency is not a tire blowout. An emergency would be your engine fell out. An emergency would be you lost your job. An emergency is specific. Something came up that was unexpected. That's the only time you'll go in there. Then after that, you're going to use the rest of the money for paying your bills and your investment strategy. Remember, this is not advice. This is for educational purposes only. One moment. All right, we're back. All right. Please remember, if you have any questions, write your questions down and email me at clapback770@gmail.com. Clapback770@gmail.com. Ask your question. I will write it out, I will take your question that you've written out. I'll answer it, and I'll send it out to everyone in the class. Remember, no question is a dumb question. If you're thinking it or wondering it, someone else is wondering also. All right? All right, so let's continue on. I do apologize for the short pauses, but that's due to having a cold. All right, so let's get into it. Again, nothing too deep right now, but we're talking about registered securities with the SEC. So when a company wants to go public or sell stocks to the public, it has to file what is called a prospectus and a registration statement with the SEC. And they call it in the business getting the skinny on the issue and issuer. Okay, so now when you think in terms of a prospectus, I want you to look that word up. What is a prospectus? See, I'm not just going to give you all of the information. I'm going to give you breadcrumbs because I want you to participate in understanding your currency. Remember, we're not just talking about money. We're talking about currency. Understanding your currency. Okay, so I want you to go understand what a prospectus is and we're going to go through one in one of the classes. We're going to go through a whole prospectus and tell you how you should be looking at the prospectus, and you should never purchase any security without reading the prospectus. Many of you have savings accounts and checking accounts, and you did not read how much interest you have or that you're getting from your financial institution. In many cases, it's 0.00002% or something like that. And they're taking your money, all your money that's in that bank, they're taking it and they're going to buy insurance policies that are having compounding interest. They're making money on top of money, charging you fees if you were to have an overdraft. But they're making money off of your account. And I tell you, you should not have money in your checkings and savings, because a lot of these accounts, like your brokerage account, you actually can pay your bills out of your brokerage account or your brokerage banking account. So you get a debit card with it too. All right. So here is what is on the registration statement and what needs to be included. The issuer's name and description of its business, the name and address of all company officers and directors, what the proceeds of the sales would be used for, and the company's capitalization. Let me repeat that. The issuer's name and description of business, clapback, description of business, to educate the general population on debt and finance and wealth. Name and address of the company's officers and directors. So whoever the officers and directors for this company, their information has to be listed. Can't be secret, must be listed with the SEC, okay? What's going to happen with the proceeds of the money that you are raising these securities for? Are you selling securities to raise money to expand a current department, or are you opening up a new research and development that's going to bring about some new medicine, whatever, okay, in the capitalization. Now, you're going to hear a term here, and you don't need to really know this too deeply, but it's called blue skies. Blue skies, registering with the states. All blue sky laws or state laws that apply to securities offerings and sales say that in order for to sell securities to a customer, the broker, dealer, the registered representative, and the security must be registered in the customer's state. The issuer is responsible for registering the securities not only with the SEC, but also in each state in which the securities will be sold. So there's a registration process that goes along with registering with the SEC, but there's also a blue sky laws where these issuers also must register in each state, and there could be some slightly different regulations that they have to go through in order to register those securities. So you, let me give you the methods of state security registration. You have notification. This is registration by filing. Notification is the simplest form of registration for the established company. Companies who have previously sold securities in a state can renew their previous application. So wherever they have sold securities, they can continue to just use the information from previous application. It is one of the easiest ways for them to register in the state. Coordination. Now, this method involves registering with the SEC and states at the same time. The SEC helps companies meet the blue sky laws by notifying all states in which the securities are to be sold. So let's just say, for instance, Clapback only wants to sell in Texas, in Indiana, California, New York, or, you know, instead of selling in all the, maybe he just wants to sell in the blue states instead of the red states, and he's selling his securities in the blue states. Well, he can do a coordination where when he registers with the SEC, SEC will give the information to each of those states for the approval. Qualifications. Companies use this registration method for securities that are exempt from registration with the SEC but require registration with the state. There are certain securities that don't need to be registered with the SEC. All right, so let's wrap this session up with this last part, and we'll come back later in our next class. So we do what is called roll call, right? You say, well, what is roll call? Roll call is introducing the team players as it relates to the securities itself. So the first one, you have what is called the investment banking firm. An investment banking firm is an institution, a broker-dealer, okay, that is in the business of helping issuers raise money. I am the issuer. I need to raise money. So you can think of investment bankers as the brains of the operation because they help the issuer decide what securities to issue, how much to issue, and what selling price to do it at. So not only do investment bankers advise issuers, but they usually underwrite the issues and may also become the managing underwriter in the offering of the new securities. Okay, so they become the underwriters. They're the ones that take the risk. Okay. Now, underwriter. Let's give you a brief definition of that. The underwriter is a broker-dealer that helps the issuer bring new securities to the public. Underwriters purchase the securities from the issuers and sell them to the public for a nice profit. So Clapback is the issuer. He goes to an investment banker. The investment banker helps to establish the price point. The investment banker helps to decide how many stocks should be issued, all of the particulars about it. And so now the investment banker buys the securities from the issuer. And they're going to go and sell those securities, And they're going to make a lot of money off of the sale of those for that issuer. Okay. Then you have what is called a syndicate. A syndicate. What is a syndicate? When an issue is too large for one firm to handle. So let's say Clapback underwriting company, investment banking company, is signing a deal to sell these securities, but it's only Clapback and three other people. But they want to sell 50 million shares. They want to sell 50 million shares. I already know that I'm not going to be able to do that. The issue is too large for one firm to handle. So the syndicate manager, managing underwriter, forms a syndicate to help sell the securities and relieve some of the financial burden on the managing underwriter. Each syndicate member is responsible for selling a portion of the securities to the public. So Clapback is responsible for selling a portion. XYZ company is given a portion. WYY is giving a portion of the securities. All of those firms are responsible for selling a certain portion of the securities. All right? So each syndicate member is responsible for selling a portion of the securities to the public. Agreeing to sell your shares. So it'd be Western versus Eastern accounts, and we'll talk about that later. So when you have this, you have managing lead underwriter. So the managing underwriter, syndicate manager, is the head cheese who's responsible for putting together the syndicate and dealing directly with the issuer. So I would be the head honcho. I'm dealing with the issuer. I am setting up the syndicate, and I'm managing this whole process. All this is important because you need to know who's handling the finances. You need to understand everything about the issue of this situation, because if you're going to be making an investment, giving your hard-earned money to people that you don't know and you're going to trust, people lose money every day. People lose retirements every day. People lose homes every day because you trust without knowledge. Okay? So the managing underwriter receives financial compensation, buckets, old buckets, for each and every share sold. So they get paid for each and every share sold. The last one is the selling group, and we'll end here. In the event that the syndicate members feel that they need more help selling the securities, they can recruit selling group members. So remember, you have the issuer who contacts a investment banking firm who helps establish the price, the number of securities, how many to issue, so forth and so on. You have the underwriters who are going to purchase the securities from the issuers to sell. Then you have what is called the syndicates that are going to issue when it's too large of an issue for one company to handle. You have the syndicate. You know, kind of like the mob. You have the syndicate. And when you have the syndicate, you have a managing lead underwriter. Now, when the syndicate is formed, if any member of that syndicate feels that they need more help selling their securities, they then recruit what is called selling group members. These members are brokerage firms that aren't part of the syndicate. Selling group members help distribute shares to the public but don't make a financial commitment. Do not purchase the share. So I go to JLB company and I say, hey, do you want to sell some of these securities? They agree to sell them. They're not going to buy them. They're only going to sell them and get a commission on it. Whereas the other member of the syndicate, they bought the securities. So they have put themselves on the line for it. But the group, the selling group, is not buying the securities. They're just moving the security. So the selling group members help distribute the shares to the public but don't make a financial commitment. They do not purchase the shares from the issuer and therefore receive less money per share when selling shares to the public. So they're only going to get a certain amount. It's not going to be as much as the syndicate members, not going to be as much as the underwriter, the bank, the financial firm, the investment firm. Okay. I think this is a good place to stop for this session, part one, to take a break. I want you to rewind, listen to what we've spoken about, and then get ready for part two of this session when we return. It's lunchtime. We'd like to welcome you to another session for our financial literacy class. I am Kevin Jones. I am your host. Let me say on the onset again of this particular class, this is for educational purposes only. It is not intended to give advice for investment. You and you alone are solely responsible for how you invest, what you choose to invest in, and how you oversee your finances. With that being said, let us get back into our lesson. So we want to pick up where we left off in our class, and we want to, where we left off last time, you had an assignment. Hopefully you completed the assignment. There will not be an assignment on every class, but hopefully you did take part in doing your assignment, okay? So we kind of left off on last class. We talked about roll call. If you remember, we talked about investment banking firms. We talked about underwriting. We talked about a syndicate, managing, lead underwriter, and selling group. Again, we're just laying down the foundation, so stick with us so that when we get into the important matters, we will be ready to understand investments. Now, for your homework, hopefully you went out and opened up a brokerage account. You understand the brokerage account and you are ready to fund your brokerage account. And you also opened up a checking feature with your brokerage account that you can transfer money in and out of your brokerage account. So let's continue on. We want to talk about as it relates to the roll call. We're going to continue that. We want to talk about who gets what in the distribution of profits. So you remember, when large issues come to market, the underwriter, which is the lead underwriter, often has to form a syndicate to help sell the securities. Now, when selling the securities to the public, each entity or lead underwriter, syndicate member, selling group, and so on, receives a different portion of selling profits. All right? Now, we're going to talk about a list of terms in order from highest dollar amount to the lowest. Now, you'll hear something that is called a spread. Now, in this instance, when we're talking about the spread, this is related to the profits that the firm who is responsible for selling the securities will receive. So when you think in terms of a spread, the spread is the difference between the amount the syndicate pays the issuer when purchasing new shares or bonds and the public offering price for each share or bond sold. So, for example, the issuer, Clapback Inc., the issuer sells shares to the syndicate for $8 per share. So I've got my money, and we'll just use small numbers. I'm going to sell sell 100 shares at $8. So that's $800 that I would receive. $800. Okay. So the syndicate will pay me $800. Okay. So $8 per share. And the syndicate turns around and sells them to the public for $9 per share. The spread is $1. It is the difference between what the seller received and the profits, or not the seller, the issuer received. Now, the seller of that security is going to receive $1 per share. This is how they will make their money, okay? So the spread equals the public offering price minus price paid to the issuer.
So the spread is just the initial profit from selling the security, but you still have to divvy it out amongst the salespeople. So within there, the company gets that dollar, and they've already agreed to pay the sellers, meaning the employees or the salespeople, how much they're going to get per sale. Okay. I know this is a tedious, but let's continue on. Next, you have what's called the takedown. The takedown is the profit that each syndicate member makes when selling shares or bonds to the public. So remember that the syndicate members are the ones taking the financial risk and therefore deserve the lion's share of the sales proceeds. Okay, now I'm going to give you a takedown formula. So it's the spread equals the manager's fee plus the takedown. To calculate this value, for example, if the spread is a dollar and the manager fee is 15 cents, the takedown is 85 cents. Okay? I just want to mention this to you. It's good to know, but again, this is not something that you're going to pay that much attention to, but it's just setting the foundation for when we get into actual investing. Concession. This is the profit that the selling group makes when selling shares or bonds to the public. The selling group members don't set up, they don't step up to the plate financially. So the selling group. So remember we talked about the selling group. So XYZ is the selling group. They are not putting up any of their money to sell the securities. So they're not putting any of the financial information up on the plate, and therefore don't receive as much as the sales proceeds as syndicate members do. The concession is paid out of the takedown. So remember in that example, you have the manager's fee of 15 cents, so the takedown is 85 cents. The profit made by the syndicate members on shares or bonds sold by the selling group is called the additional takedown. So takedown equals additional takedown plus concessions. So we have the reallowance. The portion of the takedown that's available for firms that aren't part of the syndicate or selling group is the allowance. For example, assume that XYZ Corporation is in the process of issuing new shares. One of your customer calls you to calls you up and let you know that he or she is interested in purchasing shares of XYZ Corporation from you, but you are not one of the official distributors of that particular security. Corporations, they can't get it. You're not in the syndicate. You're not part of the selling group. You're not the one that is officially distributing the stock. And so there's no sweat. You'd contact the syndicate manager who give you a discount off the public offering price. The discount is the realliance. So if you have a share at $10, they may give you a discount because you have Julie who's calling you, who's not a part of that group but wants to purchase his stock through you or the bond, the security through you, and it's $10 a share. So you go to the syndicate and you want to sell to Julie. You want to sell to Mark. So they say, okay, the stock is $10. We'll sell it to you at $9.50 a share. So the reallowance is the 50 cents, the difference between that. And then finally, you have the syndicate manager's fee. Now, this part of the spread is the profit the syndicate manager makes on shares or bonds sold by anyone. This fee is usually the smaller of all of the listed fees that are there. Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time on that. We just wanted to give you kind of an understanding of the fees that are involved when these syndicates or selling groups decide to sell the securities, okay? So now let's move on to agreeing to sell your shares, Western versus Eastern. So the syndicate group is also called the agreement among underwriters, right? Is the contract among syndicate members. This agreement includes the fee structure. Who gets what? Okay. In addition to the bucks that each member of the syndicate gets when selling the shares or bonds, the syndicate agreement lays out each syndicate member's amount of commitment, how many shares or bond each party will sell. So not all of the members of the syndicate will be selling the same volume. The syndicate manager can set up underwriters on Western or Eastern accounts. So let's talk about what is a Western or Eastern account. So Western or divided account is the securities underwriting. The syndicate agreement states that each syndicate member is responsible only for the shares or bonds originally allocated to it. So if you are allocated 1,000, you're responsible for 1,000. Now, if a syndicate member commits to selling, let's say 500,000 shares and sells them all, the syndicate member doesn't have to sell anymore. So you can stop. You can say, hey, I only want to be responsible for the 500,000. And once I get rid of those, I'm not going to sell anymore. Now, to distinguish an Eastern account from a Western account, remember the phrase Wild Wild West, because back in the day, each man or syndicate member in this case was for himself. So this is an entity that is for himself. Now, Eastern, pardon me. Remember, Western is divided. Eastern is undivided accounts. Now, in this security underwriting, the syndicate agreement states that each syndicate member is responsible not only for the shares or bonds originally allocated to it, but also for a portion of the shares or bonds left unsold by others in the membership. If a syndicate member was originally responsible for 10% of the new issue, it would be responsible for 10% of the shares or bonds left unsold by the other members. So let me kind of explain this. So let's say you're responsible for a certain amount, and let's say it's 10% of the overall security. You sell yours, but let's say someone else doesn't sell theirs. Let's say there's 1,000 remaining. So each member of that syndicate, whatever percent they were responsible for, all of those unsold shares, you then are responsible for the percentage that you agreed to. So out of the 1,000 shares that are left, XYZ Corporation, because they took 10% of the overall, now they're going to be responsible for selling 10% of the remaining securities. Okay? They're responsible for 10% of the remaining securities. All right. So let's move on. Let's talk about registering the securities. So unless the securities are exempt from registration, the issuer has to go through a registration process with the Securities Exchange Commission. So remember that. We talked about that a little bit. Now, before the securities are offered, there is what's called a cooling off period. Now, after the issuer files a registration statement with the SEC, there is a 20-day period in which they have to cool off. And during that 20-day cooling off period, the SEC reviews the registration statement. And at the end of the cool off period, the issue will happen. So basically, after you've submitted all your documentation that you're going to be selling, you file with the SEC, you file with the states or what have you, there is a 20-day cooling off period so that the SEC can make sure all your paperwork is in alignment. There are no hidden things or anything like that. Now, it's very important during this cool off period, you must understand that the underwriter is unable to sell the securities. Okay, they can obtain indications of interest from investors who may want to purchase. Okay. And this would be registered representatives. They go out and try to drum up interest on prospective stock, bonds, whatever the security is. So kind of be like, hey, let's say you do a luncheon or whatever, however you choose to do it. you can kind of say, hey, I've been working with a particular corporation that is going to be going public, going to be selling securities. They're in the 20-day cool-off period. You know, when the shares come out, they're going to be selling them for $10 a share. Here's the prospectus. Here's the information about all the key players within the organization. And you can kind of get an indication and say, hey, if and when something like this comes available, would you be interested in purchasing? And if so, how many do you think you would be interested in purchasing? Okay, so now I've spoken to John. John has said to me, hey, I kind of like what you're saying, and I know I've dealt with you in the past. And so you guess what? I want 1,000. If I were to purchase, I would do 1,000. So he'd mark that down, say he talked to Bill, and you know, he knows when it comes back that he can probably sell those stock. Indications of interest aren't binding to a customer. So it's not like when you purchase a stock or a security, once you purchase that stock, it is binding. Okay. You then have to sell it if you want to get rid of it. But an indication is not binding. So if you say, hey, when it comes out, I'm going to be interested in 1,000 of those shares. And let's say when it comes out, you decide you only want 500, or you changed your mind, you don't want to buy any. You're not obligated to purchase at that time. Okay. Then what you have is what's called a tombstone ad. A tombstone ad is a newspaper ad that is shaped like a whale tombstone. It's normally, and these are preset, it's a rectangular with black borders. It's simply an announcement, but not an offer. So you'll have the announcement of a new security for sale. Okay. It is the only advertisement allowed during the cool-off period. Now, you might get confused and think that getting interest in the security is the same as an advertisement. No, this is talking about printed advertisement. During that cool-off period, this is the only type of advertisement that is allowed. So again, it's simply an announcement, but not an offering, of a new security for sale. It is the only advertisement allowed during the cool-off period. Now, these ads contain just a simple statement of fact about the new issue. For example, the issuer, the type of security, amount of shares or bonds available, the underwriter's name, and so forth and so on. Okay. Now, there's what's called a preliminary prospectus. During this cool-off period, the underwriter can use the preliminary prospectus to obtain indications of interest for prospective customers. The preliminary prospectus must be made available to all customers who are interested in the new issue during the cool-off period. Okay, so you can't give Joe one piece of paper, the preliminary prospectus, and give someone else a different piece of paper. It is available to everyone that is interested in the public. It has to be the same document. It is a preliminary prospectus. Now, preliminary because the SEC could come back and say, we need additional information. We need you to state this, or we need you to remove this. Then you have what's called due diligence meeting. Okay. Now, toward the end of the cool-off period, the underwriter holds a due diligence meeting. During this meeting, the underwriter provides information about the issue and what the issuer will use the proceeds of the sale for. This is very important. The meeting is designed to provide the information to the syndicate members, selling group, brokers, analysts, institutions, and so on. Okay. Now, the last time that the syndicate member can back out of the underwriting agreement is toward the end of the cooling off period. So if you are the underwriter of this particular security that you've agreed to take on a certain risk, you can get out, but your last time of getting out is just right around that 20-day mark during that due diligence meeting. You can assume or make a statement that as a underwriter, you're planning to get out. Now, you've probably heard the term getting the skinny on the issue and issuer. Now, this is what we talked about when we talked about the preliminary prospectus. The issuer prepares a preliminary prospectus, and this helps the underwriter because it gives information. The preliminary prospectus must be available for potential purchasers when the issue is in registration or in that cooling off period. The preliminary prospectus is abbreviated, but it contains all the essential facts about the issuer and issue except for the final offering price, okay, and the effective date. Now, the preliminary prospectus is sometimes called a red herring. So it's called that because it has a statement in red lettering on the cover stating that it's not the final prospectus and that some items may change before the final offering. Now, in the final prospectus, which is prepared toward the end of the cool-off period, is a legal, here, I need you to understand this, it's a legal document that the issuer prepares. It contains material information about the issuer and new issue of the security. Now, the final prospectus has to be available to all potential purchasers of the issue. It must include the final offering price, the underwriter spread, which again is the profit the underwriter makes per share, the delivery date, when the securities will be available. Now, we talk about continuing the security along the way. Now, when a company issues securities and they're traded in the market, someone has to be responsible to keep track of the owners of the securities. Someone has to make sure that no more securities are in the market than there are supposed to be. So these are jobs are assigned to register and transfer agents. Because if they're only, let's say again, just to use round numbers, if there's only going to be an issue of 500,000 shares, the registrar or the transfer agent has to make sure it's not 550,000 out there. So the register is an independent entity that works along with the company's transfer agent and maintains the record of the stock and bond owners. The main function of the register is to make sure that the outstanding shares don't exceed the amount of the stock the issuer authorized under the corporate charter. That's why you should obtain the bylaws, the rules of the company, and all of that. Now, the transfer agent maintains the records of a corporation's stock and bond owners, much like the register, but also mails and cancels stock certificates as necessary. All right. So, again, just going to go over some key terms here. You've probably heard the letters IPO. That stands for initial public offering. The first time an issuer sells stock to the public to raise capital. Issuers usually hold back some of the stock for future primary offerings. So let's say, again, you're going to do 500,000 shares of stock. You may only, in the initial offer, you may decide only to do 250,000. So you then hold back the other 250,000 for later. This, at that time, it would no longer be an initial offer. Now, who profits? The bulk of the moolah raised goes to the issuer, and the rest goes to the underwriter. So the issuer is getting the bulk of that profit. That's how they're raising money for their capital. Now, you have primary offering, an offering of new securities from an issuer that has previously issued securities. A company can have an initial public offering and several primary offerings if it wants. Now, the proceeds of these sales go to the issuer and underwriter. So you have the IPO, which is the initial public offering. Then you have the primary offering. Then you have secondary offer. A sale of a large block of outstanding securities or previously outstanding securities, treasury stock, stock that issue has repurchased. Typically, one or more major stockholders of the corporation are the ones who make the secondary offer. New investors are essentially buying used, so the number of shares outstanding doesn't change. That's very important. The number of shares do not change. Now, the sale proceeds don't go to the issuer, and that's except whether treasury, treasury stocks, it goes to the big shot selling the security. So whoever is selling that security gets the profit. And then lastly, you have split combined offering. It's a combination of a primary and a secondary offering with both new and outstanding securities. A portion of the sale proceeds go to the issuer and a portion goes to the selling stockholder. Now, for IPOs, a final prospectus needs to be available to all purchasers of the IPO for 90 days after the effective date. And with a primary, secondary, or combined offering, a final prospectus has to be available to all purchasers of the preliminary offering for 25 days after the effective date for all issuers of securities. Okay? Securities are already listed on the exchanges, the NASDAQ, wherever they are listed. If the issuer has already issued securities, but not on an exchange or NASDAQ, the final prospectus has to be available for 40 days after the effective date. Again, just bear with me. We're just setting the foundation, okay? Setting the foundation. Now, let's talk about exempt securities, right? Because we talked about those that are exempt and those that are non-exempt. So what is an exempt? Certain securities are exempt from registering requirements under the Securities Act of 1933. Either these securities come from issuers that have high level of creditworthiness or other government regulatory agencies have some sort of jurisdiction over the issuer of the securities. Now, these securities would include securities issued by the U.S. government or federal agencies, municipal bonds, that would be local government bonds, securities issued by banks, saving institutions, and credit unions, public utility stocks or bonds, securities issued by religious, educational, or non-profit organization, notes, bills of exchange, bankers' acceptance, commercial paper with an initial maturity of 270 days or less, insurance policies, and fixed annuities. Now, fixed annuities are exempt from SEC registration because the issuing insurance company guarantees the payout. However, variable annuities require registration because the payout varies depending on the performance of the securities held in a separate account. So let me say that again. Fixed annuities do not have to be registered because they have a guaranteed payout. Those that are variable, because it could vary on the amount of profit, those do have to be registered. Now, that you need to remember if you still are interested in getting annuities. Now, let's go over a few rules and we'll wrap this class up for today. Interstate offering rule 147, okay? Rule 147. An interstate offering is naturally an offering of securities within one state. For such an offering to be exempt from SEC registration, the company must be incorporated in the state in which it's selling securities. 80% of its business has to be within that state, and it may sell securities only to residents of that state. The security still requires registration at the state level. So I don't want you to confuse intrastate offerings, securities sold in one state, with interstate offerings. They're different. Interstate offerings do need SEC registration because they're sold in multiple states and they can be sold to anyone. Regulation A, known as Reg A, offerings. An offering of securities worth $5 million or less within a 12-month period is Regulation A. Although this company may seem large to you, it's relatively small in market term. Regulation A offerings are exempt from full registration requirements, but you still have to file a simplified registration. Okay. Regulation D or Reg D offerings, also known as a private placement. A Regulation D offering is an offering to no more than 35 unaccredited investors per year. Now, we'll talk about credited and uncredited investors so you know what you are. Companies who issue securities through private placement are allowed to raise an unlimited amount of money, but are limited on the number of unaccredited investors. Sale of Reg D securities are subject to the sale limitations as set forth under Rule 144. An accredited investor is one. Now, let's talk about what is an accredited investor. Now, by going over what a credited investor is, you will see what an unaccredited investor is, okay? An accredited investor is one with a net worth of $1 million or more, or an investor who had a yearly income of at least $200,000 for an individual investor, or $300 for joint income with a spouse for the previous 2 years and is expected to earn at least that much in the current year. That is an accredited investor. Okay? That's an accredited investor. Rule 144. This rule covers the sale of restricted, unregistered, and controlled securities. According to Rule 144, sellers of these securities must wait at least 1 year prior to selling the securities to the public. Excuse me. Additionally, the most an investor can sell at one time is 1% of the outstanding share or the average weekly trading volume for the previous 4 weeks, whichever is greater. Okay, let me say that again. The most an investor, so you have this unregistered, you have it's restricted security, it's unregistered. Remember we talked about registered and unregistered. And control securities, the most that investor can sell at one time is 1% of the outstanding shares or the average weekly trading volume of the previous 4 weeks, whichever is greater. Okay? So we've given you our first phase of our understanding finances and investments. We're laying the foundation. In our next few classes, we're going to talk about corporate ownership and equity securities. We'll cover understanding the types of equity securities, comparing common stock to preferred stock, calculating certain values for stock, reviewing additional topics related to it. So once again, thank you for tuning in. This class is brought to you by TTG Travel. For all of your travel needs, you can email ttgtravelinc@gmail.com. Currently, there are some specials. Hopefully, these specials will be continuing on as you're listening to this. But if this particular special is not available, there will be other specials. But if you want a 5-day, 4-night cruise on any particular cruise line with no blackout dates, you need to cash app $10 to clapback770@gmail.com and say free cruise. Now, I am a businessman of ethics. Understand, free doesn't mean free, okay? Meaning, although you get the cruise for free, you still have to pay the port taxes. Port taxes are not that expensive. You still have to pay for yourself to get there. Now, if you need an airline ticket to get there, or if you need a rental car, you can simply go to ttgtravelinc@gmail.com. Give us your dates of travel. We'll look that up, fill out the information. We'll talk to you, try to get you the best fare available. But again, all you have to do is pay your port charges. The cruise is for 5 days and 4 nights. It is for 2 people. Okay. All you have to do is cash app $10 to clapback770@gmail.com. I will send you the link. You will need to do a Zoom presentation that you can set up at your time. So whenever you're free, you have to sit and listen to a presentation. I will tell you right now, it is not a high-pressure sales pitch. They want to show you a vacation package. Please do not purchase the vacation package unless you find that it's useful to you. Most of you will not. If you're interested in owning your own travel agency, your home-based travel business, which I recommend to everyone. If you take at least one trip per year, I recommend that you own your own travel agency. I can help you to do that for under $300. You can own the same software that Expedia and all of the others own. You can have your own website. You can develop trips. You can develop cruises. You can develop vacation packages. You can give. You can book airline tickets. You can book hotel accommodations. You can book any travel. Someone has a birthday coming up. You can do that. You can design a benefit packet for any corporation or any business to offer to their employees that they can use your travel services at no charges. They can either go to your website and book it themselves, or you can provide them a website, the website, which you will get a website, or you can provide them a telephone number and they can contact you and you can set up travel plans for them. The great thing about this ownership, it's not a pyramid, which means when you come in and own your business, I don't receive any of your commissions, okay? You can determine what commission level you want to be, whether you want to be paid 50% commission, 70% commission, or 90% commission. That is based upon the price point that you want to come in at, okay? There is a silver, bronze, and platinum package. And with each of those, you do get perks. When you sign up, you'll get an airline card with your picture on it, with your ITA number on it. You can use that card, depending upon when you're traveling, to get upgraded seats when you go to the airport. You get fam trips. You get discounted trips. You can design trips for churches, synagogues, any group. You want to develop a girls trip, you want to develop a guys trip, a couples trip, you have the ability to do that. I only get paid $100 for referring you, but after that, I don't get anything on the work that you do. But the great thing about it is, think about it. If you own your own travel agency, when you and your girls do girls trips, or when you and your family's going on a trip, you can book your own trip, not only get the best price, but also be paid a commission off of the very trip that you're doing. So again, ttgtravelinc@gmail.com. Simply email me and say travel business, and we will get that information to you. All right. Thank you for listening today in our class, and we will be back next time.